Stay tuned after the show for a message from Chevron.
Former President Barack Obama set to release his new memoir this week. He talked with Oprah about it in a revealing conversation about some pivotal moments in the White House.
We spoke to the 44th president on the release of his new book, A Promised Land, a memoir of his early years and first term.
I don't know if you've heard, but former President Barack Obama has a new book out. And despite not answering my DM inviting him onto our podcast, he's been going on a bit of a media tour.
You question, in A Promised Land, your own vanity and ego.
By the time I entered into the Oval Office, what interested me was, what could I get done?
Alex Guillen, you this week were able to look at that book, A Promised Land, and we got to get the former president's take on a lot of environmental battles that you and I had covered in great detail at the time.
I think when you look at the three big issues that he talked about on energy and environmental issues, basically Obama is arguing that they came in with the best of intentions, but found that ultimately these sort of responses were so much harder than Obama had really thought they would be at first.
I'm Anthony Dragna, and this is Politico Energy. Today, Politico's Alex Guillen on how former President Obama views his own environmental record. It's Friday, November 20th. So I think let's just go through these kind of one by one. And one of the big issues that he explored was obviously the failure of cap and trade legislation ultimately. And former President Obama put a lot of the blame on Lindsey Graham. What was his takeaway from that battle?
Well, for starters, one of the things he noted, in retrospect, is that he found that just because he adopted a policy position that a Republican had backed in the past, cap and trade in this case, it didn't mean that any Republicans were going to back him when it came from a Democrat. But anyway, as folks will of course remember, cap and trade did pass the House, but then when it got to the Senate, which was also controlled by Democrats, unfortunately what he found as he was trying to pass that bill was that they would still need a few Republicans to sign on because they were expecting to lose a few Democrats from fossil fuel states.
We're not scaling back our efforts. We haven't changed our goals one bit. We are simply trying to figure out what the magic formula is to be able to get 60 votes. But our goal remains exactly what it was before.
So he turned to Lindsey Graham.
There are Republicans out there who understand that carbon pollution is not a good thing. It's a bad thing. But they worry about the economic consequences of a poorly designed cap and trade system.
Who was seen as somewhat more of a moderate back then, I think. But they found ultimately that no matter how many concessions they made, he wasn't able to convince any other Republicans to sign on to the bill.
We just need to get these parties in a room, and we shall not come out of that room till we get legislation.
This all happened to come to a head right around the time of the big BP oil spill at Deepwater Horizon.
Inspections have revealed 3 known leaks, now pouring out up to 5,000 barrels of oil every day.
Lindsey Graham took the opportunity to bail on the talks. So at that point, and ever since, major climate legislation has been DOA on the Hill.
So let's talk about Deepwater Horizon, the BP oil spill. Some critics at the time called it Obama's Katrina, and I think the takeaway I got was basically this was far harder to solve than they initially thought. And there's also a scene with the energy secretary effectively solving it by napkins. Walk us through kind of the administration or Obama's experience with that tragedy.
The technical challenges that were presented by the BP spill, I think, really took Obama by surprise.
This last weekend, we tried the top kill exercise. There were 3 different top kill attempts made in 3 consecutive days. 30,000 barrels of mud was placed down the wellbore, unsuccessful at overcoming the pressure of the hydrocarbons coming up through the wellbore.
I've heard multiple iterations of the napkin story over the years. But in the book, Obama writes that he brought in Stephen Chu, who was then the energy secretary. And of course, the Energy Department, despite the name, doesn't really have a lot to do with day-to-day aspects of oil drilling. But Obama's thinking was bringing in a Nobel Prize winning physicist couldn't hurt things. So he was in the Oval Office one day. David Axelrod popped in. He, of course, was one of Obama's top advisors. And he said he had just been to get some lunch at a deli near the White House. And he had found Stephen Chu there, writing on the back of a napkin.
Secretary Chu, is that you? What do you have in there? Let me see.
To come up with the technology to try and stop the well leak. Ultimately, of course, Stephen Chu and BP and other federal experts did come up with the capping stack technology that worked, and they ultimately were able to shut off the well and end that disaster.
I think an interesting part of this book appears to be the former president paints a rosier version of the Copenhagen Climate Summit than I think a lot of people would tell you occurred, about how Obama and Clinton, who was then the Secretary of State, made this late-stage intervention to try to claw something back and achieve some sort of positive result from the summit. Obama quotes his body man, Reggie Love, of telling him it was, quote, some real gangster shit back there after they were able to salvage something from the summit. Do you want to tell us kind of what Obama's take on Copenhagen is and how that differs from kind of maybe the conventional consensus about it?
The Copenhagen Climate Conference in 2009, this was coming on the heels of the Kyoto Protocol finally taking effect in the countries that had ratified it. The U.S. Very famously, of course, did not. Europe, Canada, Japan, a lot of the big industrialized nations, where they were hesitant to enter into any sort of further agreement on that. Also, they were concerned that a lot of other countries that are now major emitters, but historically were not subject to enforceable limits as well. So here we're talking about places like China, India, Brazil. So Obama came into Copenhagen saying that he wanted to try and find a new way forward. But the problem, he wrote, was that those nations that hadn't faced obligations under the Kyoto Protocol, most especially China, they were dodging him at this Copenhagen meeting. In the book, he writes about how he and Hillary Clinton ended up basically literally running around the building trying to track down Wen Jiabao, the Chinese premier who was there, and other key leaders. What came to mind for me was all those scenes in the Scooby-Doo cartoon where you've got like all these rooms in a hallway and people keep dodging in and out of them looking for the other people. And, you know, they finally heard a rumor that all the people they wanted to talk to were in this one conference room. So they ran upstairs. There was Chinese security out front.
Shot for American TV.
No.
Got to get a shot.
No.
No press. Okay.
No press, please.
No anymore.
But basically, he wrote that he and Hillary Clinton just sort of kept on walking straight forward, and the Chinese security guards chickened out and stepped back to let them through the door. Once he was through the door, he wrote that he said, look, guys, the Europeans are not going to sign on to another one of these treaties. So they ended up striking sort of an interim deal that everyone was ultimately able to sign off on.
And at this point, the question is whether we will move forward together or split apart, whether we prefer posturing to action. I'm sure that many consider this an imperfect framework.
But I don't know if a lot of environmentalists, and looking back on it, a lot of people didn't necessarily think of Copenhagen as a huge success. I don't think environmentalists would be totally in disagreement with Obama on how these things went. They were on one side of him on these issues, and I think for all of them, the Obama administration probably came up short of where they had hoped. But certainly, you know, they're a lot happier with Obama than they have been under Trump. So that's sort of the direction they're going in.
Also, the Trump administration wants to ease the rules that regulate offshore drilling in the Arctic as they prepare to leave office. Yesterday, a bureau at the Interior Department said it wants to change almost half of the regulations on its proposed Arctic Exploratory Drilling Rule proposal. The proposed changes come months after the Interior Department held meetings with oil companies and environmental groups. And many of the groups at these meetings say the changes have been on the oil industry's wish list for years. Still, because the official rule on offshore Arctic drilling hasn't actually been published in the Federal Register, it's nearly impossible these oil industry-friendly changes will come into effect by the time Joe Biden takes office, meaning his Interior Department could prevent these weaker rules from actually taking effect. subscribe to Politico Energy wherever you listen, and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. And check out the new season of our podcast, Global Translations, where we explore how the pandemic has exposed how fragile our supply chains are and America's reliance on other countries. We'll drop this week's episode on our podcast feed, but you can find all previous episodes by looking for Global Translations wherever you listen. If you want more energy news in your inbox, subscribe to our newsletter at politico.com/morningenergy. Carlos Prieto is our producer. Our senior producer is Jenny Amet. And our executive producer is Irene Noguchi. Our editor is Matt Daly. And on the show this week,
Ben LaFave,
Alex Guillen,
Catherine Boudreau,
Eric Wolf,
Zach Coleman.
Thank you, and we'll be back again on Monday.
It's only human to want to build a better future for all. Chevron is working together with women and minority-owned businesses, spending $4 billion since 2014. Because valuable ideas only come when you value everyone. Learn more at chevron.com.